Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. In my newsletter today, I'm still doing the countdown diary. I start off by saying that there's always a point in the campaign where political parties move to the center, where they decide that they want to be more sane, more rational, so that at some point when they're attacked for being extreme or a lunatic, that they can just shrug their shoulders and say, hey, there you go again. Well, yesterday was not that day for the Republican Party. We can talk about that, the embrace of the crazy. But before we do, I want to talk about the state of the race, and I want to talk about conventions. And we are very fortunate to be joined by Steve Kornacki, the man at the big board from NBC News. Steve, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Charlie.
Well, let's start with a little bit of history, because you know I told you right before we started the podcast, I've been kind of geeking out on your Twitter feed because you've been going through some of the highlights, lowlights of past conventions. And I've been thinking about this because I think the easy knee-jerk reaction to the non-conventions that are about to start is that, yeah, we're not going to miss them. We don't need them. They're circuses, they're sideshows, they're giant infomercials. So, you know, maybe this marks the end of them. And I, you know, part of me thinks that way. On the other hand, you've reminded me that there have been some emotional and important historical pivot moments that take place at these conventions.
Yeah. I mean, I think the simplest way to put it is, you know, there's no Barack Obama presidency, I think, if there aren't political conventions. You know, I mean, it was 2004 at the Democratic Convention in Boston. He was chosen as the keynote speaker. You know, sort of the speech the party designates, you know, all the networks cover it, and it's sort of going to set the tone for the entire convention. Outside of the presidential and vice presidential nominees, usually the keynote speech is the biggest one of the week. Barack Obama got it in 2004. He was a state legislator in Illinois. He was running for the U.S. Senate. He had won the Democratic nomination. He was basically unknown outside of Illinois politics and to some folks at the national level who saw him as a rising star, but that was it. And he came out there and he delivered. This is the keynote speech. I'm sure people remember it. He talks about there is no red America. There is no blue America. There's the United States of America. That only in America was a story like his possible. And it just overnight, you know, turned him into a national political player. And you go from that night in 2004, within 2 years, end of 2006, he's launching a presidential campaign. The 2008 Democratic nomination, you know, maybe people have forgotten. It was assumed for years that Hillary Clinton was going to be the Democratic in 2008. And the only thing that could beat her, the only thing that could stop her was Barack Obama and what he became, you know, because of that convention speech. That's the most famous example. But there's great what ifs. The one that I'm always obsessed with, this goes way back, but maybe some folks remember Mario Cuomo, 1984, his keynote address, and just for 8 years after that, Democrats were begging him to run for president. He never did. But I always play with that in my head. What if he did? How different could history be? But these conventions are an opportunity for parties to show people who they are in that moment. And they can pick a few people to, you know, like an Obama, like a Cuomo, to go out there and basically try to make some statement of, hey, this is what the Democratic Party, this is what the Republican Party is at this moment in history. And for voters to then decide from that.
And occasionally things happen at conventions. Things actually happen. There are votes. There is drama. I mean, I remember back in, in 1980, the drama about who would Ronald Reagan pick to be his running mate. Remember, it was people thought that he might actually have a fusion ticket with Gerald Ford. And there was all the back and forth. It's going to be Reagan Ford. What a ticket that's going to be. And right up until the last second, I mean, I remember watching this in real time when people went, no, it's not going to be Ford. It's going to be George Bush. So, I mean, there was actually some drama there. There have also been votes that have been significant over time. I'm going to go back even further than you. You know, you think about now we're really geeking out here, Steve. So the 1940 Republican Convention, where, you know, it's wide open. Nobody knows what's going to happen until the gallery erupts saying, "We want Wilkie. We want mm-hmm. Wilkie." And Wendell Wilkie, who's really much, very much of a dark horse, wins the nomination. But that all took place at the convention. Now, he didn't get elected president, but he was an historical figure because he at least kept the Republican Party from being isolationist at the moment that Franklin Roosevelt needed to mobilize the country. I mean, you have these great stories of 1924 where they did, what, 100 and how many ballots were there? 100 and, you know, 100, 100 more than 100 ballots to nominate a candidate at the Democratic convention. There was once a time in the 1950s where they threw the convention open to pick the vice presidential mm-hmm. nominee, where there was actually back and forth. You know, 1952 Republican convention, Eisenhower and Taft really went down to the wire, you know, fights over, there used to be, you know, fights over credentials, which delegation would be seated. And those fights took place, you know, up until the 1960s. So there really has been a long tradition of real drama, conventions that really boosted a party, conventions that actually tubed the party. 1972 Democratic Convention did not help George McGovern at all. Neither did 68, actually, for the Democrats. So, they have become much more scripted, drab events, haven't they?
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, at the beginning there, I was making the case for relevance of conventions in terms of what they've become. And you said it at the beginning, they've become infomercials. Each party has recognized in the last, you know, two or three decades that basically what they're getting is four nights of primetime network television. You know, basically the networks will give them 10 to 11 p.m. Monday through Thursday convention week. And so they've got an hour each night to reach an audience that they're never going to reach otherwise in the campaign. And so they script these things down to the second, you know, making sure they maximize exactly what they want to showcase in that 1 hour of television time. That's what they've become. But that's sort of a symptom of sort of how politics, I think, have been nationalized, how the parties have sorted out ideologically, demographically, regionally. I mean, the great stories you're describing there, you know, the old days. I mean, this is when political parties were sort of a national political party was sort of an amalgamation of a bunch of different regional parties that were just wildly different from each other. This is when, you know, you go back to, the 1940s and Democrats, 1950s, you would have conservative Southern white segregationists. These were the Democrats. There was one party region down there in the same party as, you know, the unions, the union bosses of the North, the Northeast, where they actually had, you know, black voters at that point. They're sharing the same party, you know, the Republican Party. I mean, you could take that right up to 1980. You're describing the Reagan-Bush drama. You know, Reagan was the conservative. Reagan was the heir to sort of the Goldwater movement. And Bush was the Eastern establishment Republican. You know, it's so hard to remember now. The George H.W. Bush of 19 ran. He ran as a supporter of abortion rights, a supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment, an opponent of Reaganomics. He called it voodoo economics. And there really was at that point in history a moderate to liberal wing of the Republican Party. Folks like Clifford Case and Jacob Javits and heavily, you know, sort of centered in the Northeast. And Bush, in many ways, you know, represented that. And that was the a bit of that, too. I mean, as you know, was the impetus for Reagan potentially selecting Ford. It was to try to offer something to that more kind of moderate wing of the party. And he ended up going with Bush. But parties would come together. All these different sort of regional factions, ideological factions would come together. They didn't have a lot of primaries going way back here to the 50s and 60s, 40s and 50s. They didn't have, you know, the kind of robust primary system we have now. So there'd be, you know, a delegation boss or a couple of bosses within mm-hmm. a delegation, and they would hash it all out at the convention. It wasn't about television coverage. It wasn't about scripting it. It was really, you know, anybody who was there from the press really was an observer. And the people on the floor were paying no mind to what
that's right
might be seeing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I mentioned the 1972 Democratic Convention. I think I'll get the hour slightly wrong, but George McGovern ended up, because things were so chaotic on the floor fighting about platforms and other things, that he didn't deliver his acceptance speech until what, like 2 or 3 in the morning?
Yeah, it was 3 in the morning. His own people that. Did that to him. That was the amazing thing was, you know, that was the McGovern forces. They were the purists, right? It was the student activists, all this stuff, the new left. And, you know, they got to the vice presidential nomination And like every delegate had their own favorite candidate for vice president. So they nominated like 47 candidates for vice president from the floor. And they pushed the nominee, the presidential nominee's acceptance speech, to 3 a.m. I mean, it's amazing.
No political party would allow that to happen, because this this is the whole point now of the convention, is to have that prime time acceptance speech. But things didn't work out. And of course, the whole vice presidential thing was a fiasco in 1972. He picked Thomas Eagleton from Missouri to be on the ticket. And then it later turned out that the Thomas Eagleton had gone through a period of depression and had electroshock therapy, which for some reason became absolutely disqualifying, and he was forced to drop out. I mean, I don't know whether that would be the case today.
And the great postscript to the Eagleton affair, in addition to that whole drama and then Shriver coming in, was, you know, that famous line about McGovern that had been given to Robert Novak during the campaign, that McGovern was the candidate of amnesty, acid, and abortion.
That stuck.
And Novak wrote in his column that, you know, this had come to him from a Democratic senator who was concerned about McGovern's potential nomination. And about 30 years later, after Eagleton died, Novak said, yeah, it had been Eagleton who gave me that quote about McGovern.
Okay, I didn't actually know that. That's really interesting. Well, I'm going to write about something about this. Just the reason I wanted to start this, because I've been going through some of my old papers, my father's old papers about the 1968 convention, because I was actually there as a 13-year-old page, which I will mention.
Oh, wow.
Again, and I've been finding, you know, the pictures from the floor of the convention and what that was like. And you're right. When you were actually there during that convention, when, you know, you had the riots in the street and Mayor Daley and you know, people, you know, I mean, it was intense. People were not focused on the television coverage. They weren't. This was hand to hand combat, and things actually did happen on the floor, and it was dramatic. So you'll like this thing. I don't know I'm not trying to put you on the spot of my newsletter, but I mean, I have to admit, I'm irrationally jazzed about something I found yesterday. It's an old picture from March of 1968. And in March of 1968, my father was campaign director in Wisconsin for Eugene McCarthy. Mm. And of course, McCarthy had gotten in to be the anti-war candidate against Lyndon Johnson, because Bobby Kennedy didn't want to do it. Bobby Kennedy, everybody wanted Bobby to run. Come on, Bobby, you got to do it. But he didn't think that you could take on an incumbent president and win. So McCarthy, who, you know, was, you know, obviously didn't have that kind of a profile, he gets into the race and shows in New Hampshire that the Lyndon Johnson is very vulnerable, and he's poised to win the Wisconsin primary. So at that moment, Bobby Kennedy says, hey, I think I will get into this race after all. And he jumps in. And, you know, his folks flew to Green Bay, Wisconsin, and they sat down with Eugene McCarthy. And my dad was in the room and said, hey, Bobby's going to get in the race. You guys, you know, you can drop out of now. We'll take over from here. And McCarthy did not do that. In fact, they stayed in the race. And they had, you know, were head to head on a number of primaries, including California in June. Mm-hmm. Of course, Kennedy was killed in June, but, in March of 1968. So here's the picture I find. It's a picture of the moment that Bobby Kennedy is announcing on national television that he's running for president. And then in the picture, there's Eugene McCarthy and my father standing there watching Kennedy on television.
That is a piece of history right there.
And you can tell from their body language how annoyed they are. So this was the moment it happened that Kennedy got in the race, and there's Eugene McCarthy watching him with my dad. So that's my own moment. Okay, so let's go back to vice presidents. Do vice presidential nominations actually matter? We spent all of this time talking about it, but with the exception of, and I'm going to conventional wisdom, of Lyndon Johnson in 1960, has a vice presidential nominee ever, do you think, determined the outcome of a presidential election?
I think 1960 you could make the case for. The outcome of the election, no. I can think of a couple states, individual states. I think, for instance, you know, the Carter Mondale ticket in 1980 does not win Minnesota without Mondale, but it didn't matter in the Electoral College. You could make an argument that Gore in 1996 was why Bill Clinton was able to hang on to Tennessee then. That's about it. You know, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think the national level, look, the example I always give is I can't think of a bigger mismatch just in terms of how they were perceived by the public, how they were covered by the press, how you look at all the polling in a set of vice presidential nominees in 1988. And that was Lloyd Benson on the Democratic side, Dan Quayle on the Republican side. And that's when obviously Benson got off that line for the ages, Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy. I can't think of a bigger mismatch. And the Bush Quayle ticket got 426 electoral votes. Lloyd Benson, you know, in his home state of Texas, the Dukakis Benson ticket took 39%. It didn't matter, I think, a whiff in 1988. My sense is, I do think the vice presidential nominee can matter if the nominee kind of, how do you say this, reinforces the image that the presidential candidate has been trying to put out there. What I'm trying to get at here is, I think the most successful vice presidential pick of modern times would be Bill Clinton with Al Gore in 1992. Hmm. And it was because Clinton, this was coming off of three straight Democratic landslide defeats in presidential elections, the Democratic Party that was seen as too liberal, too Washington, D.C., based all of these things. And Clinton, the line the Clinton campaign wanted to get out there was different kind of Democrat. And he went with the Gore of 1992. I think when I talk about Al Gore these days, I think people think of the sort of post-2000 Al Gore, who's big on environmentalism and anti-war. The Gore of 1992 was the Democrat who had voted for the Gulf War in 1991.
Right. Very, very much a centrist DLC type guy, yes.
And it really, you know, it was two Southerners. This is at a time when there was this sort of Southern moderate tradition in Democratic politics. There's two Southerners, baby boomers, moderate, Gore even conservative on national defense at that time. I think just the contrast between what that ticket looked like and what the image of the National Democratic Party had been, I think that contrast was so strong. Gore so reinforced what Clinton was going for. I think that was, you know, you look at all these states that Clinton won in 92. I think Gore helped a ton in a way that a lot of others wouldn't.
Well, that's an interesting one to focus on, because of course people were surprised at the time because they were so much alike that instead of balancing the ticket, right, you know, they did exactly as you described it. But contrast that to the Biden-Harris ticket, because Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are really in many ways the opposite of that choice, right? I mean, you have this, you know, old white guy picking a much younger black woman, first black woman to be on the ticket. So just tell me, what are you looking at to see how that plays out? I mean, you're watching this. We don't know what the effect will be as of now. There's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of wish casting on both sides going on here. How are you going to determine whether or not this is, balance out the pluses and the minuses?
Yeah, I mean, my default assumption is it won't matter. So I'm looking for something that'll shake me from that. I think the first question is just how much of a role does Kamala Harris end up playing in the campaign? Because I think there's a tendency when the vice presidential pick comes out there for either party to, you know, they're in the news that day, they're in the news that week, they're all over the place. Then they kind of disappear for the rest of the campaign and maybe pop up. They obviously pop up for the vice presidential debate. That's about it usually. So, you know, does she, you know, there are exceptions to this. I think on the negative side, Sarah Palin in 2008, you know, kind of was overshadowing John McCain, probably not in a helpful way. But I think there's a lot of these vice presidential picks really do kind of fade in the background. Tim Kaine in 2016, a very good recent example. Pence to some degree, although that was just a strange sort of circumstance. So I wonder, do we end up talking about Kamala Harris that much at all between here and the election? That's my first question. You know, my second question is sort of, I look at it more in terms of this is a unique pick because of the future of the Democratic Party, the future of presidential politics. Again, there's an assumption that Biden's a one-term president if he wins. Obviously, he could surprise everybody and run for re-election at 81 years old. But there's an assumption this is a one-term presidency, and therefore, this is a vice presidential pick that is getting a unique leg up, I think, in sort of 2024 politics. Yeah. So I think that aspect of it kind of
a little bit more weight.
Yeah.
So there's clearly in every poll everywhere, there's a huge gender gap. Does this help Biden? I mean, Biden's already winning among women. Does this add to Donald Trump's problem with women in a significant way? Do you think that this does influence voters, that there will be a subset of voters who will be more motivated to vote for the ticket because of her presence on the ticket?
I don't think it's likely, but I think it's, you know, just I don't mean that to be dismissive of her. I just think the sort of the forces that have shaped our politics, certainly in the Trump era, and even, you know, in a period, you know, going back, you know, a couple decades now, have just realigned politics in a way where the kind of voter who I think you might think of as, you know, they say a suburban female professional class, I think there's been such movement in these demographics away from the Republican Party toward the Democratic Party. It was happening before Trump. Trump's presence has just wildly, wildly accelerated it. You know, I think that the Harris pick is sort of that voter. I think this validates probably to that voter their decision to, you know, sort of align with the Democrats. But I think it was already there.
So you actually put something out a couple of days ago, pointing out that there's been a long tradition of presidential nominees choosing an opponent for their vice president. You know, we mentioned Kennedy Johnson in 1960. 1980, Reagan picked Bush, who would run against him in the primary. That was a very contentious primary, by the way. 2004, John Kerry picked John Edwards, who had also run. 2008, Obama picked Biden, who had run a terrible presidential campaign. I mean, it is kind of funny. People say, well, I don't know he was going to pick Kamala Harris because Kamala Harris had run a terrible presidential campaign. Well, yes, but I think, you know, historically, Joe Biden had run some pretty terrible campaigns. And then, of course, Biden and Harris. So we're going to see, you know, how that plays out. I'm really looking forward to the debate. OK, so I want to just move ahead before we move off of the conventions. The one thing that I'm noticing and that people are putting out a lot of historic poll gaps. That this candidate was ahead by this much at this point in the year. I'm not paying that much attention because unless I know, you know, where in the convention cycle this all is. So, for example, the most famous would be 1988. Michael Dukakis comes out of the Democratic convention with such a bump that he's 17 points ahead of George Bush. Now, then, of course, the Republicans come. They have a good convention. That bump goes away. We know how that turned out. But there has always been historically a rather, well, they're, you know, they're varying, but there's a bump that comes out of the convention. Now that we have these virtual / fake conventions, will there be a bump, do you think? Or is that something else that's gone away?
I got to think, well, I think part of my hesitance here is I just don't know what these are going to look like.
I don't have any idea.
You know, so I've seen the speaker roster. It looks like a normal convention speaker roster. I see the networks are giving it. It looks like the networks are planning to give it the kind of coverage they normally give it. I know how these, I'm thinking of TV shows and talk shows the last 4 or 5 months that have done, you know, the Zoom shows basically. Is that what these are going to look like? I got to think if they look and sound like that, it just might not be that compelling to people in a way, you know, the really kind of souped up conventions of the media.
It's weird watching a speech with applause lines, but no applause. No crowds, no nothing. It feels like, wait, it's like, you know.
I just keep thinking, you know, it's almost like trying to imagine the NFL season, you know, stadiums, you know, it's like, it's going to look like a scrimmage, right? And I kind of, I was watching the Biden-Harris VP announcement this week. And I mean, you can imagine if that gym had been filled with 1,000, you know, people, there'd be just watching that as a viewer on television, you're just kind of sucked into the energy of it. You're just used to that from these political events. And to have all of that kind of sucked out is, I don't know that really.
No, I mean, the people who get into this, you know, will describe moments where, you know, somebody comes out to music to the big crowd and everything, and they're waving and they get goosebumps. There's an emotional, visceral reaction. That's not going to happen this year.
No, and so that's I my tendency here is to say it's just you're not going to see bumps. That said, the one thing is it is still going to be, if I'm understanding this right, Biden is still going to get 45 minutes to an hour of, you know, national television time. Trump is still going to get 45 minutes to an hour of national television time. So the opportunity to reach the masses in a way you normally can't is going to be there. Of course, I'm thinking back to 2016. The convention bounces, especially for Trump in 2016, were pretty much nothing.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen, you know.
Well, we know Trump. I mean, there's nothing that I actually think it's going to be interesting to watch Biden because the expectations have been so low. I mean, you've had the Republicans invest tens of millions of dollars in convincing people that he's senile, that he's one step away from Weekend with Bernie's. And so if he comes out and delivers a coherent, compelling speech, there can be a lot of people who are, I mean, that actually can do himself a lot of good.
I got it. My introduction to this stuff was, I grew up in Massachusetts back in 1994. Ted Kennedy was running for re-election, and it was basically the only fight after getting to the Senate, the only fight for re-election Ted Kennedy ever had. And the reason was, his nephew's rape trial had come a couple years earlier.
Yeah.
He had had a night out on the town with them. He'd had to give this speech reckoning with his drinking. I mean, this was the low point of Ted Kennedy's public career. And 1994 was sort of the high point of, obviously, of Republican politics in that period. And he was running for re-election. He was running against Mitt Romney. And it was the first time there had ever been a poll in Massachusetts putting Kennedy behind Romney. And Kennedy agreed to debate him. And this was a huge event in Massachusetts politics. Is Romney actually going to knock off Kennedy? And the expectations for Kennedy's performance, because his image at that point was like Mayor Quimby on The Simpsons. The expectations for Kennedy's performance, he was going to be a drooling drunk. I actually remember this made the news like the week of the debate. They shipped in extra wide podiums so that Kennedy, he had gained so much weight. I'm not even kidding. This actually happened. And I'm just, the expectation. I remember watching this thing as a kid. Romney was going to clean Kennedy's clock.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Kennedy showed up and he still had a fastball. And it the effect, though, of the bar being set so low. And I wouldn't say it was a dazzling performance from Kennedy, but it was a very, very competent performance. And the gap between the expectations and that, I think, was so vast. He looked like a big winner. He ended up winning the race by 17 points. The debates were not what was expected then. And I see a little bit of that with the buildup for Biden here.
Well, yeah, now the debates are going to be something. But I mean, it is amazing the number of people who will say, yeah, but, you know, he's clearly losing it or something. So, I mean, it will be. And I think that Biden has done well, at least in the early parts of the debate during the primary. And of course, a scripted speech, it's hard for him to. Well, I mean, look, let's face it, he gets in trouble when he's not scripted, when he's just sort of going off and there's no discipline. So I think there's a real upside for him. Speaking of obscure little bits of detail here, since we're doing this, you know what I actually remember? I remember, believe it or not, the 1988 George H.W. Bush speech, because remember, he had been so overshadowed by Ronald Reagan. And there was that sense that he was a wimp, that he was weak. Remember, I think Newsweek actually ran a cover story, The Wimp Factor. And I remember George H.W., and I was never a big fan, that he came up and he delivered a strong speech. But the line that I remember was, "I am that man." And he described the challenge, "I am that man." And that was the moment where I thought, okay, this guy might turn this thing around. This was powerful. This guy looked like a president. He sounded like a president. He rose to the occasion. And the fact that I can remember it this many years later. So Biden has the possibility of doing that, of defining himself in the public mind, considering that, I think this has been a big mistake for the Trump folks, who have put so much effort into basically saying, look, he's going to be no drooling, head on a stick type guy. And if he comes out, he's going to look pretty good. All right. So shifting gears, we got to talk about mail-in voting and how mail-in voting is going to impact this, because you saw the survey out of Wisconsin this week. We have a tremendous partisan divide on the question of how people are going to vote. Overwhelmingly, Democrats are, saying that they're going to engage in mail-in voting. Republicans seem to have soured on it, even though there's a long tradition there. So this is the question of, will the vote totals of early voting be radically different from the election night voting? And then, of course, you had the president this morning who went on Fox Business with Maria Bartiromo to discuss the question of the post office. And this has been very, very controversial, because he's put in his own people running the post office, who appear to be slow walking a variety of things. You have members of Congress who are writing, who are very concerned about whether or not the president is actually using his clout over the postal service to somehow undermine or even sabotage mail-in voting. And let's play this. It's about a minute long. This is the president, who is essentially saying that it is going to take a lot of extra funding for the post office to get this right, and he is not going to give them the extra money which is kind of an interesting admission. So let's play this tape, and then we'll talk about it, Steve.
No, that's only one aspect of it.
This is what's holding up money for the American people. They want mail-in votings, and they want money for the post office. This is one of the sticking points that's holding back stimulus for Americans during this coronavirus.
Oh, yeah,
that's one of them.
The
Democrats wanting money for the post office for mail-in voting.
That's one of them. That's right. How would you like to have, Maria, how would you like to have $3.5 billion for mail-in voting, billion. So if you didn't have it, you wouldn't. You know how much money that is? Nobody has any idea. You know, people, they are $3.5 billion. They want $25 billion for the post office because the post office is going to have to go to town to get these great, ridiculous ballots in. You know, there's nothing wrong with getting out and voting. You get out and vote. They voted during World War One and World War Two. And they should have voter ID because the Democrats scammed the system. But two of the items are the post office and the $3.5 billion for mail-in voting. Now, if we don't make a deal, that means they don't get the money. That means they can't have universal mail-in voting. They just can't have it. So, you know, sort of a crazy thing.
How many states will be doing
that? Those are two of the items, but there are many more
states legislature.
So, Steve Kornacki, let's just talk about this is going to be an election unlike any other election because of this, the impact of mail-in voting. So tell me how you're looking at this.
It's obviously a variable we haven't had before. We've been watching, you know, closely in the primaries that have been playing out this spring and summer where they've had, universal or you know, near universal mail-in voting, trying to see if there's a pattern. In terms of who's taking advantage of it, there seems to be. You're seeing it in the polling. You mentioned it, you know, it's in Wisconsin. I've seen this elsewhere too. You see it in the polling, you see it in some of the turnout. Democrats seem much more eager to engage in mail-in voting. I mean, I guess it doesn't seem surprising when the president and the sort of titular head of the Republican Party is talking the way Donald Trump is. You don't see a lot of Republican enthusiasm for mail-in voting. You have seen a number of these, you know, primaries that have taken place. I think it's been interesting where they've had extensive mail-in voting. They've had high turnout. In some cases, they've broken records. They've come near breaking records. I was looking at, you know, Kentucky, for instance, where they had a Democratic Senate primary. Very, very high turnout that mail-in voting seems to be bringing about where it's being used. But there also does seem to be a real partisan gap there. I think it raises a real question. You know, we talk so much and we're going to talk so much about how confusing election night /election month might be. It sets up the possibility there of some real stark shifts in terms of the vote reporting. What I mean by that is if Democrats in a state really heavily engage in mail-in voting and Republicans don't, but Republicans really heavily engage in same-day voting like Trump wants them to do and Democrats don't, you could get, for instance, the early votes that are counted would probably be the same day. So you might get a big Trump lead reported out early on.
Do we know how that actually works, though? I'm going to clarify that. So the early votes are sitting there. They're not opened until when? Can't they open?
It depends by state. There are some states that have a prohibition. They have a law prohibiting them from opening the ballots received a week before Election Day. Election officials can't do anything with it until the polls close. So here's the thing that I'm looking at that I think is interesting. Florida already has mail-in voting in place. They're used to processing it. The ballot has to be received by Election Day. So you're not going to have that, you know, week or two tension there. And they are allowed election officials to begin counting the ballots as they receive them. And what that has been in the past as an efficient count. And so I do think there's a possibility in Florida on election night that we get basically all the vote counted. It's a possibility. Just in terms of, and I think if you get a state like Florida, that's a bellwether, and you can get an accurate and reliable and full count on election night, it's not going to be enough for anybody to call the election, but I do think that's going to offer you.
You'll have a sense. But you were, before I interrupted you, you were going through this scenario that I think we need to be really aware of, that that if in fact the Democrats engage in, you know, primarily vote early, Republicans wait until Election Day and they count the same day votes first, you actually could have these first numbers coming out very skewed toward Donald Trump, right? That look like he's got a lead or that he's won a state. And then as the other votes are counted, you begin to have what's been called the blue shift. So this does complicate election night. So let me ask you this. I mean, you are the guy. What is election night going to be like? I guess part of it is, can people in the media resist the temptation to treat this election night the way every other election night has been, which is that you know, assume that we're going to get a result this night, as opposed to maybe this is the day that, you know, we start the count. Do you know what I'm getting at? I mean, it's
sure, yeah.
How do you not get sucked into the premature punditry that we all, you know, love and admire?
Right. No, and I there's a lot of there are a lot of valid concerns out there about how this is going to go, and I think you're getting at them there. The first thing I would say is, from my standpoint, from my network standpoint, and from what I can tell, everyone else's standpoint who's in the national media and going to be dealing with these things, there is a universal recognition that this is not going to be settled on election night.
Okay.
For all the reasons we've been talking about, and so there's not going to be a rush there. Now, look, I say that there is uncertainty here in terms of how a number of states are going to process this. For some of the issues we're talking about, it is a state that right now does not allow the ballots to be counted before election day. Is that going to change between now and election day and thereby expedite the counting process in that state? So I want to leave open the possibility. This is, I think, something that everybody across the aisle is hoping for, the possibility that this goes more smoothly than some of the predictions right now. But I think we are aware of the distinct possibility that that won't be the case. And we are preparing, I think, with the assumption that that won't be the case and that we need to be prepared for that. So I think I saw an article recently, I think it was in the New York Times, that was it was Ben Smith in the New York Times, who was saying he was shocked talking to media people that they seemed to be very, very blasé about this. I will just say strongly and emphatically that that is not my experience within my network in talking to literally anybody here. And that's not been my experience in talking to folks at other networks.
How long will it take? I guess the nightmare that a lot of people have been experiencing is, are we going to see things like what happened in New York, where it took 6 weeks to call the victory? I mean, then you start having a real problem.
New York's the biggest single mess that we've been watching these play out during this primary season. New York's the biggest single mess for two reasons. Number one, the time, right? It took, as you're saying, more than a month to get results. Number two, 21% in New York City, 21% of mail-in ballots were rejected. You're getting rates, the typical rate you're seeing in other states like California that have been doing this for a while is like less than 1%. You're getting 21%.
What happened there?
So there's all sorts of issues with where the signature needs to go. In a lot of cases, this is technical stuff where it's confusing, I think, to the average voter who gets the ballot. Oh, I didn't know I need to sign there. I'm supposed to sign here.
Right.
You know, I think that's happening. And there's a question. This is what I say. There are lots of questions here. There is a question about whether any of this is going to change in New York, both in terms of design of the mail-in ballot, in terms of instructions that might come with it, these sort of procedural questions. This is kind of up in the air right now, and we're waiting to see. But the implications of something like you're saying in New York, the implications of what happened in the primary repeating itself in the general election, I really don't have any doubt that Joe Biden's going to win New York State.
Right. New York's not the problem.
Source of votes for him. And think of the popular vote, the national popular vote. If there is a long delay in getting the vote out of New York, and there's already a pretty long delay in getting a lot of the vote out of California, those are the two biggest individual banks of Democratic votes that are out there. So you may have a situation where Biden is winning the popular vote on a scale that Hillary Clinton won it by in 2016, or maybe even more. But that does not come into view in the popular vote count for some time.
Right. And again, so we know that New York and California are really not in play. Is there any reason to believe, though, that we'll have those kinds of problems in the states that do matter? Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, North Carolina. And do you have any sense yet whether they have their act together in a better way than New York?
We have not seen issues on the scale that we did in New York anywhere else. New York seems to be a particularly bad case. Now, I'm saying this in terms of the rejected ballots. In terms of the time to report out the results, I'll give you an example. Kentucky is not going to be a swing state in a presidential election, but this is the kind of issue that can occur. They released on primary night the votes that were cast that day. And the votes that were cast that day were about 15% of all the votes that were out there.
Wow.
Basically, over the course of the week, they released the mail-in votes. And this was a Democratic primary, but this is something that could happen. The pattern I'm describing here could happen in the presidential election. What I mean is the same day votes went heavily for one candidate. His name was Charles Booker. He overwhelmingly won the same day votes. The mail-in votes went heavily for another candidate, Amy McGrath. People had voted for her, you know, a week or two ahead of time. And so it looked like Booker was going to win if you were just looking at the numbers that came out there on election night and that stayed up there really for a week. And then there was one day when basically all the counties in the state released pretty much all at once their mail-in totals, and the race completely changed. McGrath took the lead. McGrath won.
How many days did that take?
That took a week.
Okay, so this is the scenario. I mean, imagine in a Trump Biden election, if in fact you had a swing state, something like that happened. I talked about this with Cyril Longwell on the podcast yesterday. I can certainly imagine Donald Trump coming forward with Bill Barr over his shoulder, declaring victory, saying, you know, I have won, here are the election results, and that as these other votes come in, he will make a major push to make it sound like they are somehow, you know, illegitimate, or that something funny is going wrong, and that you start to have legal challenges about the votes that are being cast. I mean, that's why this can be messy. That's why there's probably no way to avoid having days long counting. But if this race is close, it could lead to all sorts of, all sorts of back and forth. You could have two candidates claiming victory. I mean, because you understand the importance of being the first to claim something, you know, to create a reality, you know, who's on the mountaintop first, who has the right of possession. And my guess is that Trump is, if he has any opening whatsoever, will claim that, okay, I have won Pennsylvania, I have won Michigan, and then essentially saying that anything that happens after that is cheating, it's fraud, they're stealing it from me because I won on election night.
Yeah, and there's two things on that. Number one, I think we got a sort of small-scale preview of what you're describing in 2018 in a number of congressional districts.
Yes.
In California. Because California is one of these states where it takes a month. They are very slow at counting this. Now, there is a good government argument that California ought to get its act together.
Sooner.
But the point is, you had a number of House races that Republicans led initially, even led for a few days or a few weeks after election night. And then as more and more mail-in votes came in, the Democrats took the lead and the Democrats won the elections. And you saw it sort of at a low level, not at the level you're describing, but you saw a lot of that starting to sort of percolate up there from the right. The flip side, I mentioned this earlier, but I would just say it again. The hope I have, this nonpartisan hope that I have, just for the sake of clarity on this, either way, is in particular Florida, and I think there could be a few other states that fit into this category, but I'm really thinking about Florida right now and the possibility that we get a clear result from a state like Florida on election night. And I think, you know, if you did, that would override potentially, okay, we've got 12% of the vote in Pennsylvania or 12% in Michigan, and it says this. Here's a clear result with like 98% of the vote counted.
No, that is really something to watch for. Okay, I think I've asked this question of others, but I really wanted to get your take on all of this with, you know, the president going all in on casting doubt on mail-in voting. This is extraordinary to me because I'm old enough to remember when Republicans used mail-in voting extensively. In fact, they kind of used to own the absentee ballot, get out the vote efforts in places like Wisconsin. Is there a danger that Trump could be suppressing his own vote if, in fact, he is discouraging Republicans from voting early?
Yeah, I think there's a possibility there, certainly. If that results in any number of Republican voters not voting early and then for whatever reason not getting out there and doing it on election day. But like I said, it does raise the issue for us in the media of we're now getting used to, as mail-in voting gets more and more common, we have been getting used to the idea that the mail-in vote might look a little different than the same-day vote. But I think that what you're describing ought to be really getting in the minds of somebody like me, where we say that gap that we're used to could be, you know, twice, three times, five times as big. I mean, I remember in 2016, this is a cautionary note that will live with me for a long time. there was all sorts of analysis of the mail-in vote that was taking, excuse me, the early vote that was playing out in Florida. And it looked, for all sorts of metrics, it looked very promising for Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
It's out there even saying, it looks like Hillary Clinton's got Florida in the bag.
I remember that.
And what we saw was that same day vote on election day in Florida. It, look, the Democrats, they just voted early and the Republicans just voted on election day. They were both equally enthusiastic. They just voted at different times. And in the end, there were more Republicans than Democrats. But that one will live with me for a while, the memory of that.
Okay, so in the few minutes we have left, your read on the polls right now, I mean, obviously, what strikes me is how consistent they have been, how durable Biden's lead has been. Now, of course, the conventional wisdom is it will tighten. But what are you seeing here? These swing state polls continue to be very, very tight, but there are a lot more swing states than we had expected earlier. So give me your 30,000 foot analysis here.
Yeah, I see what you're seeing there. I am looking for signs that it's tightening. I think there was a bit of a false alarm in the last couple of weeks. There was a Monmouth poll that came out the other day that had it at 10 for Biden. That was down from their poll of a month ago, which had it at 11.
So that's
still a very... I think you can make a case that maybe it has tightened a very little bit, but it's still a significant lead for Biden. It shows up in the national polling. It still shows up in the key state polling. The latest round of polls out of the big three in the Midwest there, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, had it a little tighter there than we've seen. 6 in Pennsylvania, 6 in Wisconsin. I think 4 the poll had it in Michigan that I saw this week. So that is a little tighter. That's worth watching. I think the one thing that kind of sits in my mind is the story of the Trump campaign in 16 and the Trump presidency has been, he will go through periods, sometimes just a couple days, sometimes a few weeks, where his numbers will dip. His approval rating will dip. His gap against a Democrat in a head-to-head will dip. And Trump entered one of those periods, I would say, in May this year. It didn't happen immediately with the coronavirus. For the first couple months, his poll numbers remained about as healthy as they've been for him. But it was really when the George Floyd protest began, his numbers, his approval rating, his standing in the head-to-head with Biden really started to crater. My question is, in the next couple months, does just sort of the way that the coronavirus evolves, do the racial justice protests you've seen, do they really kind of fade out? They've already in a lot of ways done that. Is there a way for Trump to get back to baseline? And baseline for him, I think in 2020, would be a mid-40s approval rating sitting at about 45% within about 4 points of Joe Biden in the horse race nationally. If Trump can get there, then I think anything within 4 points in the polling nationally, really anything within 5 points of the polling nationally, raises the possibility of the Electoral College victory for Trump, the popular vote split. So that's kind of what I'm looking for. Does it get to 5 or less? It's not there now, but it's not that far away.
It's not that far away, and when you're at 4 or 5, it then becomes possible to do that drawing to an inside straight and winning that Electoral College again. In fact, it's certainly possible that Joe Biden could win the popular vote by a larger margin than Hillary Clinton and still fall short on the Electoral College. So, I mean, that's the scenario that people need to keep in mind. I sometimes see that people have locked into the narrative of how his poll numbers have collapsed, and he's out of the race and he's certain to lose for re-election. And I think, I think that's a bit premature. On the other hand, I also don't sense the Democrats are very complacent because they still suffer from the PTSD of 2016.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. You mentioned the possibility of a bigger popular vote margin for Biden and still an Electoral College loss. Yes, I mean, you put Kamala Harris on the ticket. Maybe you squeeze, a few more votes out of California. Maybe Texas, you lose it by 4 instead of 9. You're gaining popular votes. Maybe in New York by a bigger margin. You can see ways for Biden to increase that popular vote edge. But still, if Trump's able to reassert himself fully with the non-college white voters, does he still find a way to, he doesn't need to win all three of those Midwest states, I think. Does he find a way to win Wisconsin? Does he find a way to hang on to Arizona? And I think the polling that I've seen in Arizona lately has been a little closer. Trump's still down, but I'd say about 4 points down in Arizona. And I think his other big challenge then becomes Florida. The polling has been surprisingly bad for Trump in Florida. But I think, can he hold on to Wisconsin? Can he hold on to Arizona? Can he hold on to Florida? I think if he's getting those three, it's going to signal everything else that he needs will fall into place for him in the Electoral College. He's not there yet in any one of those three, but that's kind of what I'm looking at today.
Yeah, and none of those are inconceivable at this point. Steve Kornacki, thank you so much for joining us again on the podcast. We always enjoy having you on.
Thanks, Charlie. Appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.